Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we will be talking about ethics in public life, very specifically in government. And our guest for the program is Dennis Thompson. He's on the faculty of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's professor of public policy. He is also Alfred North Whitehead Professor of Political Philosophy in the Government Department in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. He's also founding director of the university-wide Edmund Safra Foundation Center for Ethics. And he's written and spoken quite a lot on this subject, ethics in government. He's authored a number of books, and I just like to mention them. They include Just Elections, Creating a Fair Electoral Process in the United States, Restoring Responsibility, Ethics in Government, Business, and Healthcare, Political Ethics and Public Office, and also Ethics in Congress, From Individual to Institutional Corruption. He served as a consultant to the Joint Ethics Committee of the South African Parliament, the American Medical Association, the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Ethics, the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, and also the Department of Health and Human Services. He is visiting the campus to take part in a symposium. This is the Klein Symposium, Spinning Democracy, the Ethics of Deception and Government. It's sponsored by the Center for the Study of Democratic Governance. It's going on today and tomorrow, and he is going to be giving the keynote address tonight. And we're very pleased that he could be here with us to spend some time on the program. Questions and comments from people who are listening are welcome, as always. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief so that we could keep things moving along and accommodate as many different people as possible. But certainly, questions, comments from people who are listening, they're very welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, call us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure.
I want to ask you just a very general question, one that you pose rhetorically in the introduction to the book Restoring Responsibility. That is, if you look at the number of cases within the past few years, newsworthy cases of ethical lapses in government, in the world of business, in the world of religion, we certainly have had them. And it has led people to raise the question, as you do, are we in the midst of some kind of corruption crisis? Is it any worse than it has ever been?
I don't think it's actually any worse than it's ever been. It's very hard to measure these trends over time. I suspect that what's happening is that we're more aware of what's going on. Wrongdoing is more likely to be exposed than it was in the past. Certainly, on the whole, though many people will doubt this, but I think I firmly believe it, that the members of Congress and state legislatures are probably, on the whole, more honest and less corrupt than they were 50 or certainly 100 years ago. What's happened is that we notice more often the bad apples. And also, there are another trend, I think, which is the bad side of something that's good. There are a lot more different kinds of people, that is, women in politics, African Americans. Diversity has come to our state and even national legislatures, and that means that people have different ideas about what the right thing to do is, and it's no longer the cozy, comfortable, all-white male circles that are deciding things. So you have more ethical controversy, and it just therefore seems as if things are getting worse.
Mm-hmm. I suppose you one would draw some encouragement from the fact that we want our elected leadership to behave in an ethical manner, and we have high expectations, and that I think one would argue, well, that's a good thing. They may not necessarily always live up to our expectations, maybe not even their own, but it is a good thing that we at least expect them to try.
Well, I think that's true. It would be a true, much worse crisis if we ceased to get outraged by wrongdoing. And as in some European countries, which will go nameless, we don't shrug our shoulders and say, c'est la vie, that's politics, and don't worry about corruption. And I think, though, to some extent, American politics it has, because of money and tradition, a lot more corruption than some advanced democracies. It also has a citizenry that still has the capacity to get angry and outraged when somebody does something wrong.
Mm. I think, too, that you point out in this particular book that perhaps we spend too much time, or that is, we put too much emphasis on the behavior of individuals, individual cases of misconduct, and don't think enough about the way that the institutions in which those individuals operate may have problems, and that we need to address it on an institutional level and not just on an individual level. When we see someone who has done something, to single them out, to say, yes, you have, to sanction them, that there's a bigger context that you say that we should look at.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think very often we focus on the Duke Cunningham or Bob Ney cases, the individual who basically takes a bribe, or Foley in the Page scandal, and neglect the conditions that have been created. And here I don't want to let anybody off the hook, because it's still individuals who are responsible. The Foley-Page scandal is a good example of that. It's the leadership in the House, including some staff members, who did not take steps when they should have in advance. So when I say institutional, I don't mean sort of the systems to blame and no individuals are. I mean honest leaders who are trying to do a good job have been negligent in certain ways, and they haven't paid attention to the defects in the institution that they're running. Hmm. And that's what we should be paying more attention to.
Can, if, for example, we're going to take as our case study the Congress generally, can you, and you, I suppose you could ask the same question about any organization, can mm-hmm. that organization, can we really expect it to police itself?
No. And particularly, I think, legislatures, because they are even, the members depend on one another to get their jobs done, and it becomes kind of cozy over time. So in the Congress, the Ethics Committee go in cycles. Sometimes it's partisan, as it was in recent years, and there's partisan gridlock, so they don't actually discipline any of their members. Or it becomes bipartisan, a kind of collusion. It's also the equivalent to gridlock. They don't do anything because they agree among themselves that it would do damage to both parties if they got into an ethics war. So it's an impossible conflict of interest, members judging themselves. The solution is a semi-independent body many states' legislatures have already adopted, but Congress has been resistant to this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we wouldn't be surprised that Congress would be resistant to
yeah.
that. What would it take to have the members of the Congress, for example, agree to adopt something like that?
It might take a political miracle. As you suggested, David, that it's very difficult to get members of Congress to adopt anything that might be risky politically, and they don't want some outside person or organization coming in and judging them. But although many of us have been arguing for a number of years that this semi-independent body, it's not completely independent because it wouldn't be constitutional, is a good idea. Only recently, and for the first time in the last session of Congress, a bill proposing such a commission or an office was brought to the floor and received 30 votes. And I celebrated. I didn't break out any fancy champagne, but it took something maybe equivalent to a political miracle. I guess Barack Obama and John McCain were two of the co-sponsors, and I don't know how long that alliance is going to last. But That's progress when we can get 30 votes on something that never before had more than two or three.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dennis Thompson. He's on the faculty of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and is frequently called on to comment on issues involving elections and ethics and political campaigns. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It does seem that periodically the spirit of reform does seem to seize the Congress. It has happened fairly recently, and perhaps they were forced to deal with this because there were some high-profile scandals involving Jack Abramoff and some other people. And there was a lot of talk in Congress about change, particularly addressing the rules, changing the rules that under which lobbyists operate, and about who they are and how they have to be registered and how they have to talk about what it is that they do and what sort of things members of Congress can accept. And it looked at as if at one point there might actually be some significant reform. And then very slowly it sort of it died out until it went away completely. Now, I suppose the cynic would say that the members of Congress, that they did a lot of posturing, they did a lot of talking about what they wanted to do. And then when the public's interest began to wane, then they realized, oh, okay, well, this really isn't all that important. And they just waited for things to quiet down and for the news media to go on to other subjects. Now, it may be that. It may also be the fact that what they were talking about doing was difficult politically to get everybody to agree. And maybe it died out because it was just a hard thing to do. Do you think it's one or the other of those things? Is it both? Is there something else going on?
Well, I think it is a hard thing to do. First, it hasn't died out completely. There was there were some moderate reforms made. The lobbyists now, the registration system is more effective than it was before. There's the revolving door problem, which I think is the most serious, was tampered with a little bit. That is, you can't go immediately from Congress and start working. There's a longer waiting period and start working for a lobbyist organization. Certain trips, kinds of trips, are not allowed anymore. But some of the worst offenses have not been touched. I mean, campaign. Many people don't realize that lobbyists were actually the chairs of finance committees, fundraising committees for members of Congress in many cases, which is, talk about a cozy relationship and interdependence. I think you're right that, and this is another example of bipartisan collusion. Neither party wants to do anything to make it harder to raise money for campaigning. They both suffer, and so as soon as it gets off the front page, and they both are quite happy to agree not to carry the reform as far as their rhetoric would suggest. It does take scandals to get attention, and we did get some reform. We should take comfort in that. But we should keep beating on them too, and reminding. Now it's the Democrats are in control of Congress. They won that in part on a promise to do something about ethics reform, and some members are trying to remember us, remember that, including a couple of representatives from Illinois, and we should hold them to it.
Do you think that the central issue, the thing that really is at the heart of our concerns about ethics in Congress, is campaign finance, the way that we pay for political campaigns?
That's certainly the single most important cause of most of the problems of at least of the honest members. And I said earlier, I think most members of Congress are honest. Some of your listeners may not agree. But the way we finance campaigns in this country, which is unique in the world in the form that it takes, really does create conditions for corruption. Even honest people have to raise money from citizens and other groups that, quite understandably, are giving them money not just because they think their programs or legislation they might support is good, but because they want access. And they do get access. They don't get votes, usually. Only in extreme cases do they even get things put in the congressional record as a result of their campaign contributions. But there's no doubt, it's been shown, that they get special access, and access to a member of Congress or his staff or her staff gives you the chance to shape amendments and minor provisions of bills and things like that, which are very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Is the fact that there hasn't been, this seems to be something, certainly, if I base this on what, the kinds of conversations we've had on this program over the years and things that people have said, things that callers have said, things that, that you read, it seems that there are a significant number of people, of Americans, who think that this is a problem and it's something that ought to be changed. At the same time, there seems to be among members of Congress, and I'm sure also state legislatures, we should note that, in fact, as a matter of fact, in the state of Illinois, there are no limits, zero, none, no limits on how much money you can give to a political candidate. And here people have said, well, the way that we deal with that is by having timely reporting of campaign contributions. I'm not sure that that really has solved the problem very well, but, you know, the fact of the matter is there are no limits. You could, if you want to give somebody $1 million, you can.
That's, of course, for state offices.
That is correct.
Illinois hasn't seceded from the
union. No, you're absolutely correct. That is, I should be very clear. Yes, if, for example, somebody was running for the governor, was running for the state legislature, for a statewide office, there are no limits. That is absolutely right. Be that as it may, this is something that I think that a lot of people are really concerned about. And at the same time, it seems that members of Congress are really loath to do something that I'm sure they see as being something that will encumber them and make it more difficult for them to run, given the way that things are. And I'm not sure if it's actually a majority of Americans just don't care why it is that we haven't seen something. And I know that also it is also the case that at various states, they have on the state level, they have done some experimenting. And I think there are some places where they've actually made some progress on this. But I guess, given the fact, again, that I think a lot of people are concerned about it, I wonder why it is that it's not, on the national level, it isn't more of an issue.
Well, that's a fair question, it is true that if you ask, most public opinion surveys over the years and most focus groups have said that citizens do think this is a very serious issue and something should be done about it. One of the problems is what you should do about it is quite complicated. The most natural expert opinion often suggests public financing. Mm-hmm. That means more, not necessarily more taxes, but that hits a different part of public opinion, which is that why should we want to pay money to these politicians to run for office? And so you get that kind of, I think that's a misguided sentiment, but that can be exploited by members of Congress who don't want to regulate or provide financing. And then if you start on the regulation side, limits on contributions, you run up against the First Amendment. I think myself, it's a misinterpretation of the First Amendment, but you have a whole line of court decisions which have been used to, you referred to other states. Maine had a very good plan for public financing. The Clean Elections Law, I thought, was quite a good experiment, but a significant part of it got struck down by the Supreme Court. So I think we need to consider a bit whether or not we've gone overboard in interpreting the First Amendment as protecting unlimited amounts of money being spent, if not contributed, to campaigns. I think it's time to realize, campaigns cost money, but we don't have to have them totally dominated in an unregulated way.
I just want to, again, invite people who are listening, if you have questions, comments you'd like to call in, and certainly that's welcome, as always. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Once again, our guest is Dennis Thompson. He is professor of public policy. He is Alfred North Whitehead Professor of Political Philosophy at Harvard University. He's on the faculty of the Kennedy School of Government. He's also founding director of the university-wide Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics. He's here visiting the campus to take part in a symposium. This is the Klein Symposium, Spinning Democracy, the Ethics of Deception in Government. He'll be giving the keynote speech tonight. This is sponsored by the folks here at the Center for the Study of Democratic Governance. Questions, again, as I said, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And we have someone here to bring into the conversation on our line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Am I mistaken, or is this finding that contributions are in some way a form of free speech and therefore cannot be limited, a rather novel interpretation of the last 20 or 25 years?
Contributions can be limited, but expenditures can't.
No, and that's what I actually meant to say.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is an odd, it is, isn't it? I mean, I think you're pointing to this, a rather odd result. It comes from the 1970s case, Buckley v. Vallejo, which says just that we can place some reasonable limits on contributions because of our interest in preventing corruption, but we can't limit expenditures by candidates because that's a violation of free speech. That's because speech is money or something close to it. I myself, this is a longer argument, but I think that's a mistake. And it sounds as if you also are skeptical of this. Is that right?
I think a high degree of skepticism, yes. I'm wondering if we don't also have a problem with the Supreme Court, that it seems to be more interested in continuing the power structure as it exists than it is in a rational interpretation of the Constitution.
Well, it's certainly the Supreme Court and its current membership does seem to reaffirm more traditional views. And whether that's a good thing or not, it certainly does seem to be the case in this area as well as in others.
There is another point I'd like to ask you about. It seems to me that the permission of a candidate to spend unlimited amounts of money, of his own money, is in some respects inimical to the cause of democracy.
I agree with you on that. I think many people would not. They'd see it as an infringement of individual liberty if you want to spend your money on whatever you want, and if you want to spend it, you know, better than on running for office than buying a yacht, maybe. The only way that any state that has been able to deal with that problem is by public financing, and then what happens, of course, if you get true billionaires spending their money, the government can't give you enough money as if you're his opponent. So what happens, in effect, is that the limit, when you accept under most of these schemes, if you're a candidate and you accept public financing for your campaign, you have to observe certain limits on your spending. And but if somebody enters the race against you, who's a billionaire and starts spending over the limits, doesn't take public financing, then that restriction on you is lifted, and you can spend any amount you want. Now, obviously, I don't think that's a, I mean, that's a makeshift solution, isn't it? Because it just sort of, all bets are off when you get a billionaire into the race, and we have a spending race that ordinary candidates can't win. So, yeah.
And we do seem to be getting a billionaires club in the Senate, particularly today. Well, thank you. I certainly appreciate your comments. It appears that there'll be no one accepting public money in the coming presidential elections.
Yes, that's it. Certainly appears that way, and that's because we haven't raised hasn't been adjusted for inflation how much money that you can get. So it's not worth trying to observe. It's just the limits.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. That's just to be clear, what happened there was, at least so far, at some of the leading candidates, because in order to get the public money, you have to agree to certain limits on how much money you can raise all together.
How much you can spend.
Yeah. And then they figured that their potential for raising money from private sources was so big. They said, well, we're not going to take the public money because that has the strings attached. Then it puts limits on how much we can spend. We don't need to do that. We can go out and raise all the money that we want out there in the marketplace.
That's right. I mean, when a candidate can raise a year before the election $25 million, as Hillary Clinton did or Barack Obama almost did, and then the public financing support looks ridiculous compared to that. Mm-hmm. It's very troublesome, actually, and I think the press, I can understand the reason, but we're already, as you saw, David, and I'm sure others, your listeners did, what we learned about the candidates, the big story 2 weeks ago, was who raised how much money, and it was like the horse race for, you know, would Barack Obama get as much as Hillary Clinton? Well, not quite, but almost. And that's better because the expectations were lower, and is his better because it's he gets more small contributions, and Mitt Romney has only a few donors, and instead of talking about what their issue stands are, we were talking about how much money they raise and from whom, and that is not the way to run a campaign.
Yeah. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Questions, again, are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dennis Thompson. He's on the faculty of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and has written a lot and speaks often on issues of democracy and elections and ethics and political campaigns. Questions are welcome. We have been talking here about the problem of campaign finance and money in politics. Let me ask you about something else that is different, but is also something that I know is on the minds of a lot of people today. And then, generally speaking, that is openness in government. And by that, I guess I mean having our political leadership be open about what they're doing, about why they're doing it, about giving justification for why things are done, having it be a sense an open and deliberative process in which people theoretically can participate. And I suppose related to that also is the issue of accountability, that leadership, we hold them to account for decisions that they make, particularly when they make bad ones. What can we do to foster and encourage greater openness in government?
Well, I agree with the premise of your question. We should have greater openness. There are far too many secrets. I mean, every time somebody suggests Sunshine Law acts opening up the archives for secret, people cry national security. And after 9/11, that seems to be a trump card. But in fact, the number of secrets, there's actually an office in the government that's in charge of keeping this track of the secrets, and they're growing and growing. And in fact, it turns out even that the standards for classification of secrets is itself a secret. So we don't know how exactly what the standards are, how they're being applied. And this, I mean, I have some sympathy with the effort to protect confidentiality. You can't get candid advice from your counselors if everything, you know, is open. I wouldn't put a television camera in the West Wing. Actually, I guess we did. We had a TV program called The West Wing. But you do need some opportunities for candid and confidential advice, and the opportunity to negotiate and bargain behind the scenes is part of politics. But when the advice takes the form of task forces, two instances, just to show you I'm not partisan, Dick Cheney's task force of a few years ago on energy, we still don't know who the members were of that. People suspect that they were industry representatives to try to help develop legislation that would protect the industry, but that the membership at least should have been disclosed and open, and some of the deliberations should have been public. Similarly, though, Hillary Clinton, back in the early days of the first Clinton administration, had some health care task forces, and they were also secret. The membership was even kept secret for a while, and I think that was part of, there were many reasons for the failure of that health care reform effort of the early Clinton days, but that certainly was one. So we should require by law that task forces be open, and just to take a small point, we should not allow the classification of secrets to get out of hand as it has. On this, I'm critical of many of the things that the press do in Washington particularly, but the press, given the fact that they have an interest in this, but they have been a force for the good in trying to bring more to light, and so I hear one cheer for the media.
Mm-hmm. Well, there again, I suppose that the public demand for openness would be a significant force in moving in that direction. And again, it's as is the case with campaign finance reform. Maybe it's the same people
that would be
arguing for both issues. One wondered if there was a greater public outcry, whether this was something that government would have to pay more attention to, and why there isn't perhaps a greater public outcry.
Well, there should be. Maybe if you and I keep talking, there will start a movement here and right here in Illinois.
Well, anybody who's listening, you want to, again, get into the conversation, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, Dennis Thompson, from Harvard University. He's on the faculty of the Kennedy School of Government. You're the founding director of this foundation, Center for Ethics, and I think previously it had a different was called something else, but essentially it's been around here for on your campus for a while as a sort of cross campus, cross departmental kind of entity. And I'm interested in the issue of how we address ethics in public life broadly, and whether you think that in the past, at least on the level of the academy, where we have people that we're training then to go on into various kinds of, they're going to go on and they're going to be business people, they're going to be in the clergy, they're going to be in the communications world, they're going to be in politics, they're going to be in all that, whether as we train them in their professions, we have devoted enough attention to generally to the issue of ethical behavior, no matter what it is that you do.
Well, that's one of the reasons we started the center, is that we thought that the training in ethics for young medical students, business students, law students, and other in journalism and other professions was not adequate. It was either done by, say, philosophers parachuting in and talking about theories, which didn't connect really to what the practice was going to be, or sort of over-the-hill doctors or telling war stories about how bad the medical profession had become and how good it was in their days. And what we wanted was a sort of rigorous training, not in how to not take bribes, but the hard dilemmas that young doctors and lawyers will face when they go into practice. Physician-assisted suicide, the limits of criminal defense in questioning lawyers, prosecutorial discretion, which we saw recently in the Duke case. Those kinds of choices that young and older professionals are going to have to make, we thought, and I think most people have agreed across the country in professional schools, this hasn't been addressed as rigorously as it should have been. And that was our mission, to help correct that, and we've been joined now by dozens, if not more, other institutions doing that.
We have a caller here, someone on cell phone. Let's get to them. Line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, first, thanks for being on the program. It's really nice that you're addressing this issue. I feel like I may be going backwards here, but made a comment about all of the president's counselors in the West Wing and something of some secrets or secrets made sense when they wanted to talk openly, and I'm not sure I get that. I understand that there might be something that has to do with specifically with security of some sort that may not want to be shared because it might mess up a case or whatever, but my point is that I don't think most of the other secrets, as you say, make much sense to me. And I'm going to hang up and listen to your program. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Well, the caller is appealing to my transparency side. I'm generally in sympathy with the idea that too much is kept secret, and in a democratic government, small d democratic government, we should have openness. But I think the caller would probably agree that in any organization or any decision-making body, you need to have some periods of time to talk candidly with your close advisors, who have to feel free to try out ideas in a kind of brainstorming way. And if you know, as people have pointed out, our constitutional convention was secret. It was closed. Press wasn't allowed in. Members weren't allowed to talk about what was happening there. And if it had been under the glare of publicity, compromises wouldn't have been made. Interesting ideas wouldn't have been floated. So I think there is a case for confidential deliberations. I don't think that it follows from that all of those deliberations have to be kept secret forever or even indefinitely. And certainly records have to be kept. If you use email, you shouldn't use the official, you shouldn't use the Republican National Committee email and then make sure that you can't find it later.
Do you think that the president be able to, as apparently the president can arguably now do, say that all official records of everything that happened in the White House during his administration for, I suppose they would use, they're always going to use the issue of national security, for that kind of reason should be kept secret. And as in fact, this president has been criticized for not only doing that for his own records of his own presidency, retroactively, he has gone back to the records and materials from other presidents. He said, "No, that we need to keep those closed too." Should a president be able to do that?
No, I don't think the president should have the authority to do that. I think that there is a legitimate reason for keeping some records secret for some period of time, not as long as and not as many as are currently done. But the key question is that the people who are making the decision about that shouldn't be the people who are trying in the position to protect themselves from embarrassment or mistakes. So it's a conflict of interest. There should be an independent judgment made about how long the secrets need to be kept and which ones should be kept.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that I do find myself wondering if, for example, we could put a camera into the Oval Office. We'll create a C-SPAN channel that's got a camera on all the time, and we see what's going on in the Oval Office. It would certainly not be as decorous as what happens in the West Wing TV show. I wonder really what it is people would actually think if they could see what really went on in the Oval Office.
Well, yes, we saw or heard, at least, in the Nixon White House what went on, and it was not too pretty. And I think we wouldn't have wanted to see everything that went on in the Clinton White House, and probably for different reasons in the current White House.
Let's talk with someone else here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I missed a middle chunk of your program, so you may have addressed this, and if so, that's okay. Anyway, it's often said that years ago, the private lives of politicians were private, and we didn't report on their sexual peccadilloes and that sort of thing, and that now we focus so much on that, perhaps, and we perhaps lose some very qualified public servants because of that. Did you address that trade-off and whether we have changed and whether it's good or bad?
We didn't address it, so I'm sorry you missed the center part, but you didn't miss that, and I think that's a very important question. What's happened, it's not all that recent, but it really dramatically started with the Gary Hart case. Before that, mostly, if you remember that.
Right, I do.
And now it's the sort of private lives are fair game for politicians, at least, and not only in this country, but even in France. In the recent election, you saw suddenly the Americanization of the campaign. I think this is unfortunate, not because sometimes these things aren't relevant. You can make arguments that the health of the candidates, which used to be private, are relevant. Even matters of character. It's not totally irrelevant that Bill Clinton had difficulty in controlling. He didn't just lust in his heart, as one president did. But even when it's relevant, it seems it drives out, there's a Gresham's Law here, drives out the more relevant issues. And just because of the nature of private life is easier for us to understand, or it's titillating, and it gets more attention. And so it overwhelms the campaign or the political judgments that are being made. So it's a matter of balance, and I think we've got it out of balance right now.
How do we get it back in balance?
Well, good question. I was going to ask you. It does depend on a certain amount of, I think, responsibility on the part of the media. The media says, well, the public wants this, or they wouldn't listen to it. But there are a lot of things that we listen to tune into that we would just as soon, in our more reflective moments, not want to have. And so I don't take the market as a good test of this, and I think journalistic ethics needs to, I'm not very optimistic about this, but needs to be strengthened in this regard. And I think, you know, citizens like you and me and David have to, you know, sort of call people on this, call the press on it, call the critics on it.
Maybe someday we'll get bored with people's private lives and say, well, I don't really care all that much. But that'll take a long time when we've got all these channels pumping it at us 24 hours a day.
Well, let's hope that that's the case. I hope you're right.
Thank you. And you're working in an extremely important area.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are certainly welcome. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dennis Thompson from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Back at the beginning, we talked a little bit about the perception that perhaps people have that somehow there's more corruption in public life and in government and business and everywhere than there has been before. And your answer is, well, no, actually, there's probably good reason to believe that ethical standards may indeed be higher, but it's something that we're paying attention to. We have created more rules to govern people's professional conduct. we are increasingly hold them accountable to live up to the rules that we have written. I think one of the things that has happened, and you certainly touched on it, and you touch on it in this book, is the fact that we now have some greater degree of public oversight. That is, we have various kinds of panels and bodies that have been constituted. In hospitals, we have ethics committees. And we have committees that in some places they're created to oversee the activities of police departments. And so, you know, various kinds of panels that do have a citizen component and at least make this effort to get the public involved in this, in the oversight process. And I would assume that you would say that would be a good thing. And perhaps if we could somehow expand that, that would be a good thing.
I do think that's a good thing. Right. Certainly the citizen involvement in these panels and hospital ethics committees are a good example where citizens perform, in most cases, make an excellent contribution. There is maybe, like most good reforms, some of these get overdone. And you set up an ethics and institutional review board in a university to check on research to make sure that patients and clinical trials are not abused. And pretty soon this committee feels it doesn't have enough to do. It starts looking into all sorts of other kinds of research, and it gets a little out of control. So it is important to keep a certain balance in these things, and we don't want an overly regulated society or university or hospital. So I'm always on the guard against setting up too many bodies to do too much in the way of ethics regulation.
We have one more caller who want to try to get him in. And up in the – well, there are two. We'll try to get at least one. The caller on the toll-free line is in the northern part of the state in Geneva. This is line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
You know, I wondered if – how much percentage-wise do you think the media plays in creating presidential elections? I mean, as far as influencing elections. Because basically my comment would be – I think the media drives who gets elected and who doesn't.
Well, the media certainly has a major influence, but the truth is that most people don't change their minds very much during a campaign, despite what the media does or what the candidates do. There are a few people, the least informed, and the people who listen to the media the least, oddly enough, who often tilt the election. So I'm not prepared, actually, to blame the media for all of our mistakes, but they certainly are an important factor.
Yeah, I suppose, though, it does go back to an earlier issue that the media does have this tendency to put the spotlight on early favorites and on the horse race aspect of things, which then again goes back. It hooks into the money thing. It seems that we, you know, rather than the media identifying some candidate because the media responds to that person's ideological position, the media is saying, oh, look at this candidate's ability to attract support from people who think that they would be a good candidate. And the major marker is how much money. And we just talked about that earlier.
Follow the money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're at the point where we just about have to finish, and I'm sorry I have another caller here that we can't really take. What last sort of thought would you like to leave with people?
Well, yeah, a soundbite against...
Other than not to lose hope, maybe.
A soundbite against soundbites.
Yeah, exactly.
I think, as quite a few of your callers have shown today, and I hope there are many others out there, this is an issue which the public... citizens like you and me really care about, and we want to bring it. We should be much more active in making sure that our elected representatives and appointed officials know that. And ethics is important because It's the foundation for getting anything else done honestly and effectively in government.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that for this first hour of Focus 580, with our thanks to our guest, Dennis Thompson. He's on the faculty of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's a professor of public policy. He is Alfred North Whitehead Professor of Political Philosophy. He is also founding director of the university-wide Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics. He's visiting the campus to take part in a symposium. This is the Klein Symposium, Spinning Democracy, the Ethics of Deception in Government, sponsored by the Center for the Study of Democratic Governments. He'll be giving the keynote address tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.